Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. What do the languages Greek, Spanish, German, Persian, Hindustani, Bengali, Celtic, Kurdish, and even our modern-day English all have in common? Well, they all share a language ancestor that was spoken some 5 to 10,000 years ago. All of these languages and many more are part of what's known as the Indo-European language family, and their common ancestor is referred to as Proto-Indo-European. Half the world speaks one of the languages descending from Proto-Indo-European. The biggest one is English. Today we are going to be in conversation about this history and how we've come to trace a language that was never written down, but can still be found in words we use today all over the world. My guest for this conversation is Laura Spinney. Laura Spinney is a science journalist and author of the book Proto: How One Ancient Language Went Global. Laura Spinney, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this program.
Hello, Mitch. Thank you for the invitation.
I love this topic. I told you before we began on air, oftentimes we have publishers who come to us with books, but I actually found your book just out of my general interest. And I started listening to the audiobook, which was really amazing, amazing narrator in that as well. And then I was like, this is so good. And I went to go look at the publication date. I'm like, oh, it was just published. We could probably interview her. Let's reach out to her. So I'm very happy to have you on. And maybe we could begin when we talk about this history of Proto-Indo-European language. Again, we trace back, I think, some 5 to 10,000 years ago. We'll talk more about all that. But help make this real for me about how all of these other languages share this common ancestor. Can you talk about some of the words, perhaps, that are similar or that have some connection that we find amongst different languages? And we're not talking about just European languages. We're talking about languages in Asia, in India. What are some of these common words? Make this real for me.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And in fact, this whole concept of an Indo-European family starts several centuries ago when people started to notice these resemblances across the branches. There are many examples. One of my favorite ones is the word for star, which just kind of goes to show that people have been looking up at those twinkly things in the night sky for a very long time and calling it by, at least in Eurasia, in the part of the world where these languages are spoken, by essentially the same word. So, for example, Ulysses, when he's coming back, making his journey back, he's talking about aster. That's the Greek, the ancient Greek word for a star. And I have to say up front, by the way, that you have to forgive me if my pronunciation is not always correct, because I am not a linguist myself. So I'm an amateur like everyone else when it comes to the pronunciation.
And you're also dealing with many, many, many languages that have descended from Proto-Indo-European.
This is true. So the ancient Greek word would be aster. The Sogdians, who were the middlemen on the Silk Roads over there towards China, their word for star was something more like isteri. And the Icelandic word was stjarna. So from those three words, historical linguists have reconstructed a kind of ancestral words which would have sounded something like chester. But the point is that they were noticing these resemblances across these languages, which were spoken sometimes very large spans of time apart, but also huge geographical distances apart. And in the end, they defined this family, which even in the ancient world was spoken from sort of Ireland in the west to the frontiers of China in the east. After 1492, after the age of exploration and the invention of the ocean-going ship, those languages then skipped to other continents. And that's why, you know, today Indo-European is regarded as the largest language family on Earth. Nearly half of humanity speaks an Indo-European language as their first language. So it's vast. But what I'm trying to answer in my book is, what were the events that gave rise to that huge diaspora, which meant that the family that we call Indo-European was already spoken over such a huge swathe of space in the ancient world?
Are some of the other words that I think are easier perhaps to find a connection, basic words around family? I think like daughter, father?
Yeah, daughter is another excellent example. So the ancient Greek word for daughter sounds something like tugatera, thugatera. The Armenian word, duster. Dochter is Persian. Old English, dochtor. And so you can see all of these words share, it's fairly obvious, share an ancestral root. And that is true for many of the words that connected with the nuclear family, many basic concepts, essentially. We talk about a core vocabulary where the words don't seem to change very much over time and space. They kind of get inherited in a fairly identical form with sort of slight sound changes, as if, you know, we were all playing a giant game of Chinese whispers. Probably one of the reasons for that kind of stability of that core lexicon, that core vocabulary, is the fact that we can't really tolerate misunderstandings. These are such important concepts to our survival, and certainly in the ancient world, that in the words that have to do with nuclear family, with numbers, with basic concepts like water, wind, or night, or with the lowest numerals, or with the animals that we survive, that we live with and survive upon, that are part of our essential economy, those words tended to be rather stable across large stretches of time and space.
How about the word mother? Is that more universal?
Mater, yes, mater, mama, mater in Latin. Yes, although there's a slight caveat that you have to make there, which is that babies, one of the first words that babies utter is mama. You know, that is something that even babies that will grow up to speak languages that are not Indo-European will start uttering that word which they connect with their mother. So, in fact, one of the tasks of the historical linguists who are trying to define a language family and which languages belong to that family is they must exclude those words which all babies utter, or they must exclude words which, for example, resemble each other by chance, or because of onomatopoeia, because we create the word that sounds like the sound of the thing. I'm struggling to think of an example of onomatopoeia at the moment. Oh yes, I give one in the book, which is barbarian, which originally meant somebody who spoke a foreign language, somebody who spoke something that I can't understand, blah, 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 rhubarb. The word has the same essential root as blah, blah.
Oh, and barbarian comes from Herodotus.
Well, Herodotus, yes, it was a word in Barbaras, a word in ancient Greek, which Herodotus certainly inherited, yes.
And it didn't have this derogatory, my sense is he didn't use it in a derogatory way. It was more just used as people who spoke a different language. It sounded like bar, 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 as you're explaining.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably a moot point. Because essentially what it means is a member of an out-group, right? Somebody who's not in my group. And so I would say there's some built-in pejorativeness to that since the beginning of humanity. But no, you're right. It probably didn't have the sort of barbarian as in savage type signification that we would immediately associate it with now. It just meant somebody who doesn't speak my language.
My mother is interesting to me, though, where how languages from other language families also begins for this ma aspect with when it comes to mother. And there are other language families. There's Sino-Tibetan, Afro-Asiatic.
Mm. Depending on how you count them, I mean, there are different counts. Some would say hundreds of language families. Some would say, I think a more kind of acceptable number, more consensual number is about 140. But they're very unevenly distributed. First of all, they're very unevenly documented. The Indo-European family is one of the best documented. Many of those families are very patchily documented, if at all. But of those 140, most human beings speak the top five. So, you know, a lot of them are very small, with very small speaker populations. And in the top five, yes, there's Sino-Tibetan, Indo-European. They're sort of vying for the top spot. Afterwards, you have some of the African families, Niger-Congo, Afro-Asiatic, Austronesian is another big one. Have I made up five there? I'm not sure. I might be missing one. But yes, so Indo-European, of which the major representative today is English, Sino-Tibetan, of which the major representative today is Mandarin Chinese. Those are the two behemoths.
Yeah, it's Sino-Tibetan. That's why it would be the second largest.
Well, it depends again how slightly how you measure it. I mean, you can measure in geographical spread, you can measure in terms of numbers of speakers, first speakers as opposed to second speakers and so on. But yes, so I think at the latest count, Chinese Mandarin has more speakers than English, but Indo-European, the whole family, has more speakers than Sino-Tibetan.
You are joining me from France, from Paris, France. I think, again, I was listening to the audiobook, so it wasn't like I was taking particular notes when I was doing this. So if I get this mixed up again, I'm happy that you will correct me. But I think you said about French. The French are Celts speaking Latin.
Well, so... yes. So the idea, there was a lovely quote, which I'm not going to be able to remember verbatim, but of somebody who said that French is essentially Latin put at the service of the Celtic mind, because you have to imagine that here there was a large Gaulish speaking population until the Romans came in and took charge. And Gaulish was a Celtic language. And, you know, when this happens, you get wholesale, when empires expand, you get wholesale language change very often, not always. But the mechanisms can be wildly variable. And it didn't happen all at once. Probably what happened was that Latin became the language of administration in the big, you know, centers of population. But the rural areas continued to speak Celtic Gaulish for a long time. And so, you know, you're inevitably going to get some hybridization, you're going to get words crossing, you're going to get a sort of Celtic substrate which will affect the language that emerges from that mixing. And along with that substrate, along with some of the words and the sounds and the grammatical constructions that come in from the Celtic language are kind of parts of the worldview, where parts of the psychology, concepts, ways of seeing the world. And the example I give of that in the book is the French word 80, which is 420s, which is the French word for 80. And the reason for that, because it jumps out of you in an otherwise decimal system of counting, because the Gauls, the Celts, had a vigesimal system of counting, base 20. Unlike the Romans, who were base 10. So you have this kind of Celtic substrate breaking through at that point in a rather stunning way.
And French is considered a romantic language, a language that has its ancestor is Latin. Is it Latin? And then English is Germanic. And oftentimes people are surprised because we have so many Latin-based words in English, but we consider English to be a Germanic language. Germanic and Latin, are they direct descendants from Proto-Indo-European?
So Proto-Germanic, you have to imagine a sort of branching family tree with a single root. Now, before we get millions of people again writing in, that is an oversimplification. It's one model. Languages change by descent, by inheritance, that is, but also horizontally by loans and so on. So there's much more to it than that. But that is one way of thinking about it. And so you can trace all the Germanic languages, which are a sub-branch of the Indo-European family, up to Proto-Germanic, which, yes, descends from Proto-Indo-European. Then you have Proto-Celtic and you have Proto-Italic. Latin is a descendant of Proto-Italic. And Latin itself then branches into all the Romance languages, of which French, Italian, Spanish, and so on, Romanian, are the daughter languages. French is very definitely a Romance language that is descended from Latin. But as I say, it's had all these other influences, which is what makes studying the languages is so fascinating, because they have been molded by the experiences of their speakers. The migrations, the wars, the epidemics that those people lived through have left their imprint in those languages.
And that's why we find I think like 60% of English vocabulary comes from either Latin or maybe even directly French.
It's definitely a hybrid. It's a bastard, to use a very unpolitically correct word. But, you know, that's part of its strength, its great adaptability. And it's great, you know, depths of expressibility. And, you know, there is no such thing as a pure language. Every language is a hybrid. Of course, the point comes where you have to ask yourself, is this still, in the case of English, a Germanic language? And that question has been asked. It had such a huge influx of Latin words at one point, a huge influx of Norman French words, of course, after 1066, Norman French being an Italic and a Latin based language, a Latin derived language. So yes, the question has been asked, but I think the consensus, it's fair to say, is that English remained essentially in its fiber Germanic.
And calling English a Germanic language does not mean that English comes from German. It means German English would share that same ancestor.
Yeah, they both descend from the Proto-Germanic ancestor, along with the Scandinavian languages and Dutch and some others.
And you write that English may be the language that has drifted the furthest from this Proto-Indo-European?
Did I say that? I mean, different languages have been through different... You know, a language can go through a very turbulent period, and when it changes very fast, and then it can go through a peaceful period. I mean, there is this rule of thumb that it takes between 500 and 1,000 years for a language to evolve, because languages are always evolving, they never stand still, to change into what we might define as a different language. That is to say that the speakers of the original language would not understand it. But that's really a rule of thumb. So sometimes they might change much faster in one period of time, if it's a very turbulent period of history, and then slow down and change much slower at another time. I don't know that English is so... it definitely has changed a lot. I know what you're referring to, yeah. It does in some of its grammar...
I think it's dealing with I think what I was referring to is sort of dealing with inflection, the way that the words were in English, you have to have a certain order.
Language, exactly. It's an analytic language and not an inflected language. So you convey meaning in English more through the order of the words and the use of different parts of speech, whereas in an inflected language, something more like Sanskrit, ancient Greek, or Latin, all three inflected languages, you can keep the words in the same place, but by changing the ending, you can change which word is the object and the subject, for example, of the verb.
And we believe that Proto-Indo-European was an inflective language.
Exactly, yes.
And that might be something we'd see.
It's interesting in that way because of all this turbulence, because of its encounters with other kinds of languages. It has been changing itself over thousands of years, hundreds of years at least, from an inflected to an analytic language.
Yeah. And perhaps Spanish and French, a lot of people speak Spanish here where I am in California, that would be closer to what you would find the sentence structure and the inflection of the words.
Yes, I suppose so, but you can also get mixed languages.
Yeah. you mentioned, because language is always changing, which is something I try to remember every time I get an email from someone who has issues with something that I said or how I said it, and that's sort of my defense, you know. Like,
yeah, actually, I think we're in a weird bit of history. Like, obviously, there was a time when people really didn't think languages changed at all. I mean, I talk about in my book Dante in the 14th century trying to persuade people that, you know, languages were changing all the time, even if it was happening too slowly for you to notice, in the same way that Darwin would say, you know, things are constantly evolving biologically, but just because you can't see it doesn't mean it's not happening. So that was a very heretic idea at the time. I think nowadays we accept perfectly well that languages as a whole change and evolve, but we don't like hearing about our own languages changing and the fact that, you know, in 200 years time they may not be the same as what they are today.
So sort of takes the rule of thumb you said was 500 to 1,000 years for a language to basically morph into another language. We see this with English, Old English. It's really impossible to understand if you haven't studied it. You can't go back and read the original version of Beowulf, one of our oldest pieces of writing of a complete story that we have in the English language. But I think you also suggest in the book, though, that process might be, in some ways probably speeding up for some languages around the world, but maybe for English, that's such a global language. And of course, English is speaking in India, it's spoken all over the world, and people speak it their own way. But it might, this current moment might also represent a time in which language change, especially for English, slows because we live in this modern world in which everything is written down. Writing down the written word, I guess, has slowed the change of a language.
I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, it's very difficult to get any proper linguist to predict future language change because it's so hard to predict. I actually say a bit provocatively in my book that maybe AI will help us with that particular problem because it's so good at finding patterns in large bodies of data. But let's say for the moment, it's very difficult. And that's because so many factors are at play. I mean, large scale migration can change a language. Technology can change a language. But yes, from my conversations with the linguists, I get the sense that they think we're in a pretty weird part of history since widespread literacy. So which, if you think about it, it's only a few centuries old. And you know, the concept of a national language, the nation state, isn't very old either. And both of these things have sort of imposed standards on us that did not exist through most of human history and prehistory. And so English at the moment, to give an example, rather like Sanskrit 1,000 years ago or Latin, you know, after the fall of the Western Roman Empire, that it is fragmenting. It is fragmenting into a lot of daughter languages, and that is happening. But the thing that's different now in the case of English is that though there are these many different variants being spoken around the world, and so different that, you know, they're beginning to have to subtitle each other on TV, they are... The variants that are diverging are the spoken variants, and they're all held together essentially by the same written form.
I can easily read a newspaper that's in English from India, as an example.
Exactly. Whereas, you know, Latin, if you think about it, two speakers of Latin at either end of the Roman Empire were almost certainly illiterate, and there was nothing holding back, really, the divergence of their dialects at the point that the, you know, everything started to expand and then crumble.
This is Letters and Politics, and we are in conversation with Laura Spinney. Laura Spinney is a science journalist and author of the book Proto: How One Ancient Language Went Global. It is what we are in conversation about. Let's now get into the history of this language, Proto-Indo-European. We have no written evidence of it, other than the words that we use, correct?
No written evidence of it. No, predated writing. So we're trying to... I wrote a whole book, would you believe it, about a language that's been dead for 4,000 years and that was never written down. So yes, but people were trying to puzzle out what this language was like and who spoke it and where and when for a long time before I came on the scene. So, you know, in a sense, I'm just writing the latest chapter in a story that has been going on for several centuries.
It's believed to have come from what's known as the steppes, the great steppes. This is Eastern Europe. This is also Central Asia. Tell me about what's happening sometime that we know of 5 to 10,000 years ago in this area.
Yeah. Okay, so the very beginnings of this family are a bit misty and a bit up for debate. And there is a sense in which all the languages spoken today can be traced back in a straight line to the first languages that humans ever spoke. But with that sort of little caveat aside, I think the consensus now, it's fair to say, is that Proto-Indo-European, by which I mean the mother, the common ancestor of all the Indo-European languages that are spoken today, was spoken in the steppes of Eurasia roughly 5,000 years ago. And the steppes are those enormous prairies, grasslands, flatlands that stretch like a belt across the middle of Eurasia, from Hungary in the west to Manchuria in the east. The idea is that there were these people who were herders, nomads, who emerged as a sort of culture in the steppes north of the Black and Caspian Seas, pretty much in the part of eastern Ukraine that is being fought over today, sadly, about 5,000 years ago. And they essentially invented a new way of life. Their ancestors until that point had been more sedentary, more tied to the river valleys. And these people basically worked out, figured out a way to live in the steppes all year round. And they moved with the seasons, they moved with their herds. That's not nothing, because the steppe is an extremely hostile environment. There's no cover to speak of, really. The temperatures can go up to 40 degrees Celsius in summer and minus 40 in winter. Thick snow cover in winter there, so your animals can't herd, can't graze, and not enough water in summer. So they had to work out how to do it, and they did. They worked it out. They had the benefit of probably of wheeled transport. They may have domesticated the horse. They worked out to live off meat and milk, so they were the first in that part of the world to start dairying. A huge source of protein. And because they worked out how to live in that environment and essentially unlocked for the first time the energy reserves of those grasslands in a massive way, they underwent a huge population explosion. They were also, by the way, grew very tall and lived very long and had very good teeth. That's what happens when you eat a good high protein diet. So they expanded, and the idea is that they took their languages with them. And in fact, the reason that I'm telling this story now is because the Indo-European story has been sort of transformed in the last decade by the arrival of new tools, and those tools are biological, they are genetic, they're the ability to read ancient DNA. So to take DNA from ancient remains and analyze it. And what that allows us to do that we couldn't do before, because we didn't have any written texts from that time, was to trace prehistoric migrants through space. So we can trace those people who, I haven't given their name yet, I just realized, but their archaeological name is the Yamnaya, which refers to their burial rite. It means pit grave. Because we can trace their DNA, we can trace how they expanded. And that expansion maps rather well onto one of the main theories that historical linguists had come up with previously for explaining the radiation of the early Indo-European languages.
Yamnaya. And yeah. What direction do they expand in all the different directions?
They expand east and west. They expand west into Europe and east quite a long way, as far as the frontiers of what's now China. They themselves don't go into the subcontinent, into India and Southwest Asia, Persia, but their descendants do. Their descendants come back from Europe and go down into those parts, taking descendants of their language with them.
They brought marijuana with them.
That's one theory. Yeah, they seem to have, the Yamnaya themselves seemed not to have liked alcohol. That was something that came later in their descendants, but they did, it looks like, smoke cannabis, which is a steppe plant. It grows wild on the steppe, and they seem to have scattered these charred seeds of cannabis all the way into Europe. There isn't even an idea that they were the ones who domesticated cannabis, maybe even began cultivating it for human consumption.
And their descendants are a very important part of this story, obviously. And you mentioned alcohol, in which alcohol would become an important part of the story about telling the history of these languages. And something I found really interesting, and something you find amongst different languages in words, is a connection to hospitality.
Yes. Yes. I love that word. So, as I hinted at before, but I probably haven't properly explained, the way that historical linguists essentially reconstruct dead languages that were never written down is by comparing their living descendants, right? So we talked about some of the words that were similar across branches. So if they compare those words and they have in their heads certain rules about how sounds can diverge over time, because basically this vocal tract that we have does not allow infinite sound combinations. So there are only certain ways in which sounds can diverge. So with that knowledge and with the knowledge of the living descendants of those long dead languages, the historical linguists can sort of reconstruct the ancestral form. They can at least attempt to. There's much debate and much disagreement and much discussion of what those reconstructed forms were. But they can get quite a long way in understanding what the ancestral form sounded like. So there are words that sound or that resemble English ghost and English guest and host across the different daughter languages of the Indo-European family, that sort of don't divide neatly into guest and host. Some of them mean guest and host, some of them mean guest and stranger, some of them mean there's a sort of mixing of the concepts there. The thinking is that perhaps they both descend from a single root, that is guest and host, which might have sounded something like hostis, in that kind of rather guttural H at the front. You've got the G and the H, gostis, hostis, hostis. So it's got both guest and host in it. And the idea is that the reason that both words descend from that is that because the speakers of the ancestral language had a concept of reciprocal hospitality. So if you think about the speakers of that language being nomads moving about in the huge landscape of the Eurasian steppe, they were mobile, highly mobile. They were often having to cross each other's territories, especially as the population expanded. And in order to avoid conflict, in order to sort of not tread on each other's toes and crossing each other's territory, they invented this convention of reciprocal hospitality. So you come into my land, I'm going to wine and dine you, maybe not wine you, cannabis and dine you, and we're going to show you a good time, we're going to tell you some great stories, and you'll go away our friend. And when I come to your land, you will treat me with similar respect and lavish entertainments. So that's the concept. In fact, the word hospitality and hostility probably both descend from that same concept as well, which seems strange because they seem to be antithetical in their meaning. But the idea is that they kind of converge, they find their nexus in this concept of the passing stranger, right? So if you gave the passing stranger a good welcome, he became your friend. And if you didn't give him a good welcome, he became your enemy. So I love that in that one word, hostis, is all this kind of information about the way they organize themselves socially, their norms, their values, and the way they treated each other.
And migration is an important part of the story.
It's a huge part of this story because, first of all, there are many good reasons to think that migration is a major, if not the main, motor of language change and dispersal throughout the ages. And also because, you know, we are living through a huge climate crisis now that is largely caused by us. But climate has changed, of course, naturally, over time. And it has often triggered large migrations. You know, droughts, coolings, heatings, periods of great humidity have often triggered people to move off and find better grass, better ways of earning their living elsewhere. And that has brought them into contact with other peoples often. And then, you know, there have been different kinds of meetings, sometimes conflictual, sometimes not, but also the mixing of languages. And all of these events have shaped the evolution of the languages that we speak today. So yeah, whether it was an actual climate event which caused the Yamnaya to move out, it may simply have been that their numbers were so large at a certain point that they needed to move out to find more grass to put their herds to feed their herds on. They also seem to have had quite a sort of expansionist mindset. That's because where do we get that from? Well, you know, at the same time that linguists can reconstruct their language, mythologists, who are often linguists by training, can reconstruct some of the stories that those people told from some of the sort of, you know, the basic units of stories, the poetic devices that the bards used at that time. They can kind of extract those from the daughter languages and from the daughter story traditions and reconstruct the ancient myths. And many of those myths have to do with raiding, taking other people's cows, taking other people's land, and then a whole system of compensation for that blood price and, you know, ways of taking things but then saying you're sorry and patching up afterwards. And individuals in society whose job was to resolve disputes, the chegs, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, but essentially the ancestral form of rex or raja in Sanskrit, so to us the word for king, but probably originally something more like a priest or someone who decided what was right or who regulated in disputes. So yeah, we have traces of these practices in that way as well that come down to us. And their myths are a good source of evidence that they were actually quite, you know, that built into their social organization was the, you know, pushing out the young men to go and push out the frontiers and bring new land in and bring new animals and maybe women in as well. A very patriarchal society and quite a violent one, although not necessarily as violent as was thought about 10 years ago. But that's another part of the story that I'm sure we'll come to.
I just want to stick with hospitality a little bit longer here, because I do think of, we're talking about ancient myths. I do think of such myths where hospitality was a key value in it. And these are violent myths as well. But I think of the Odyssey. I think of Beowulf. These are real. Again, it's a clear value. That of hospitality. I was fascinated by the reconstruction of myths to these, I guess, Umnaya or at least Proto-Indo-Europeans. Is there any particular myth you could tell me about? Reconstructed myth you could tell me about?
Well, the ones that I love are the dragon slaying myths. So the dragon slaying, dragons and dragon slaying are not exclusively found in the Indo-European family, but the ones that the stories that we know best, including ones that crop up in Homer's works, in Beowulf, in some of the very ancient Celtic myths, they have a similar form to them, where, you know, a dragon sequesters something that's vital to people, maidens, cows, water, usually something like that. And a hero goes and frees the sequestered thing and slays the dragon, usually having to overcome many obstacles on route. And then the hero often dies quite soon after. There's some chink in his armor that gets exploited. So, Achilles' heel is an example of that. Siegfried's the patch on his back, the shape of a linden leaf, where he's not protected, where death comes in. Esfandiar's eye in the Persian tradition. So there are these tropes in the Indo-European versions of the dragon-slaying myth, which helps you to recognize them as having come from a common form. And, you know, I mean, it's just extraordinary, isn't it, to think of some bards thousands of years ago at some feast for a passing clan chieftain who is telling these stories, entertaining the people, you know, the gathered guests, with such stories that we still tell today and that's still hugely popular on Netflix.
And the importance of alcohol. Is mead an important word?
Mead, medu, yeah, is the reconstructed form of that. So that these are some of the, because there are words descended from medu, which is the reconstructed Proto-Indo-European form of this honey-based tipple, forms of which you find in pretty much, I think, all or certainly most of the branches of the Indo-European family, which is one line of evidence to make Indo-Europeanists think that perhaps it was the first alcoholic drink that they partook of. I mean, they soon added others, wine, beer, probably a drink, perhaps while they were still in the steppe, based on fermented milk, because that's still quite popular in the steppes of Central Asia. So yes, their drinks cabinet expanded quite fast, and hospitality, storytelling, probably alcohol. You know, you can think about the fascinating research which shows that a little bit of alcohol, but not too much, you mustn't go too far, but a little bit of alcohol makes it easier to learn another language. When you're in company of people speaking a foreign language, a little bit of alcohol releases your inhibitions and helps you to learn. So the idea is this sort of package of feasting, drinking, and storytelling and hospitality in general might have been one of the mechanisms that helped the Indo-European, that eased the Indo-European languages through the networks of people that were forming as the Yamnaya and their descendants migrated further east and west. Because there is a major problem here that we have to overcome, which was that they were far numerically inferior to the populations they were coming into contact with as they moved into Europe and Greater Asia. So how did they impose their languages? You know, you'd have thought it would have been the other way around. They would have taken up the host languages as they moved there. But no, in fact, you know, we find the Indo-European languages are spoken through most of Europe, and probably within about 1,000 years of the Yamnaya's arrival at the western point of the western extremity of the steppe, that is modern Hungary. Now, they didn't go further than that, but their descendants did, and carried there both their genes and, we presume, their languages and their culture further west. And how did they do that? Well, 10 years ago, the consensus might have been that it was through violence, because this would also explain the kind of huge change, a turnover in the gene pool at that time. But now there's a much more nuanced, multifactorial explanation of how they did it, which makes it all the more fascinating to me. And a big part of that, the thinking goes, is social conventions, of which this hospitality package was a very important part.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you made me sort of, I don't want to get too sidetracked here because we have limited time, but you did make me sort of reflect and even potentially start to rethink the works of people like Joseph Campbell or Carl Jung, who saw these universal images across culture and interpreted those as universal psychological symbols. And that still may be true, but you did make me rethink some of these, like, wow, maybe these actually have more of a concrete connection across language.
Yeah,
and culture.
It is a bit of a tangent, but it is fascinating, and it's a really active area of research at the moment. And I've just written about it actually for New Scientist in a feature published a couple of months ago called Mythology-ology. And the idea is that sort of with new huge databases of information about the stories and the myths and the legends that are told across the world, and with this more sort of evolutionary mindset of thinking about sort of the way that stories and languages evolve over time, you know, building family trees, trying to trace relationships, ancestral relationships, and the absolutely accepted idea now that languages evolve and stories evolve all the time, people are beginning to change their thinking about the where and the why of storytelling. And one of the amazing things to come out of this is that some of the stories we still tell are incredibly old. I mean, some of them are not, but there are a few which you can trace back certainly as far as the arrival of the Indo-Europeans in Europe, for example. There are stories that are told by Indigenous Australians that are traced back even further to the end of the last Ice Age, because they describe, for example, shapes of the coastline that don't exist anymore, but, you know, predated the rise of the sea after the melting of the ice. And those are stories that are handed down, you know, orally. There's no written version of these stories. They've been handed down orally, generation to generation. There are some people, though this is controversial, who say that there are stories that came out of Africa with the first Homo sapiens to leave Africa 60,000 years ago, or the first Homo sapiens to, you know, who peopled the rest of the world. And one of those might even have been the forerunner of the dragon myth, you know, this idea of a serpent, a dangerous serpent that came from Africa and that remained in people's, deep in people's memories, even when they, you know, ended up going to ice-bound parts of the world where there were no snakes, which is a mind-blowing idea. Although, as I say, not everybody buys it.
Oh, that's fast. I'm going to have to find that article.
I'll send it.
Please. You chronicle the works of a number of researchers who have dived into this history and this topic of Proto-Indo-European, ranging different fields. I think being a journalist, a science journalist, you're the perfect one to tell this story, because these are three different fields, right? You have archaeology, linguistics, and then genetics. There's one particular person I want to ask you about, because I found her really fascinating, and that's Maria Gimbutas. Who was Maria Gimbutas?
Oh, she's an amazing woman. I think she died in 92, was it? I think it was the early 90s anyway. But she was a Lithuanian-American archaeologist who was extremely knowledgeable about the archaeology and the sort of folk lore and legend of Eastern Europe. And she was an expert in what she called old Europe. So Europe when it was still inhabited exclusively by farmers, the farmers who came out of Anatolia and the Fertile Crescent at the Neolithic Revolution. So we're talking, several thousand years before the Indo-European expansion that we've been discussing. She basically set out to try and explain where that world went to. Where did, you know, how did that world vanish and get replaced by this Indo-European speaking one? And she was one of the leading proponents of the steppe hypothesis, which is the one that now basically everyone has come round to, which is that these sort of nomadic, patriarchal, possibly quite warlike, at least in her conception, herders came roaring out of the steppe in several waves, and basically in the culture clash that had ensued between them and the farmers of Europe, they won. They imposed their languages and their cultures and their patriarchal way of organizing society. So she was proposing this. I mean, the steppe hypothesis itself is much older than her, but she did a lot to kind of refine and develop it. And she presented it essentially, having been exiled from her native country of Lithuania by the Soviet takeover after the Second World War. She ended up in LA and became chair of European archaeology there and presented her theory there, where it didn't go down well at all, because right after the Second World War, nobody wanted to hear about violent migrations anymore. Everybody wanted to think more about the diffusion of ideas and the diffusion of culture and languages through populations, not necessitating large movements of people. So it wasn't very popular. But nevertheless, she fought on, soldiered on, championed her theory. Her students, her student Jim Mallory, who's, by the way, just written his own book about the Indo-European dispersals, took it up in his turn, and another very important archaeologist in the States called David Anthony, author of a book called The Horse, the Wheel and Language that many people listening to this will have heard of, published in 2007, so before the ancient DNA revolution. They took up the steppe hypothesis and sort of carried the lamp after her. She's the reason she's important in this story, because she's important in a number of stories, is that she championed a theory at the time when it wasn't at all clear that it was the right theory, and that she has since been vindicated.
Yeah, she wasn't always taken so seriously. Do you think in part because she was a woman?
Well, she had this theory. There was definitely some sexism involved. Let me start by saying that. But she also had this theory that the societies of old Europe, so these farming societies that predated the arrival of the Indo-European speakers, were matriarchal, mother-centered, women-centered, and that they worshipped a goddess. And this made her extremely famous way beyond academia, way beyond archaeology. The sort of new wave feminists of the 1970s loved this idea, embraced this idea, you know, the concept that societies had been organized that way once before so they could be again was very, of course, attractive. And so she became hugely famous beyond the academy. And that obviously, that didn't please many people in the academy, but there were also genuine scientific reasons for doubting that view of things. And I think it would be fair to say that it's not one that the majority subscribes to anymore. There may have been different roles for the genders in the farming societies, in the sedentary societies, and in the nomadic societies originating in the steppe. For example, women may have had different roles in food production in the two. And it's certainly true that many, many, many statuettes of female forms have been extracted from old Europe sites, archaeological sites. So, you know, perhaps there was some worship of the women who were perceived to have invented this new way of eating, of food production. But I think that the consensus would be today that those societies were still essentially male dominated, just as warlike as the others or any other in prehistory. So that part of her thinking didn't survive And yes, for a while it was probably tied up with some disapproval of her as a woman, you know, getting above her station. But I think the ideas themselves have also had their time. They've fallen away. But on the steppe hypothesis, when it comes to the story of the Indo-European language, she was absolutely right and has been vindicated fully.
Laura Spinney has been our guest. Again, Laura Spinney is a science journalist and author of the book that she has joined us to talk about. It's called Proto, How One Ancient Language Went Global. Laura Spinney, I've enjoyed our conversation very much, and I thank you for taking this time.
It's been great. Thank you very much, Mitch.
That does it for Letters and Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez. Kirsten Thomas is the engineer. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I thank you for listening.